This is Aiden with Oddball Pilot. I'm in the United Kingdom, sitting down with Gareth Bliss, who's one of our members. And Gareth and I have been sending emails back and forth since the early days of Oddball Pilot. And he's kind of been working through his ratings, or I should say he worked through his rating years ago and is trying to get current again with the JAR, which is the European Pilot Licensing System. So we're going to talk about what that process is to get a JAR license, and then we're going to move on to his current project, which is a consolidated Catalina that he'll be flying out at air shows this summer as soon as he gets his type rating in it, which should occur next month in June.
That's right.
Yeah. So, cool. So, Gareth, let's start with kind of your process with getting the JAR. You started years ago.
Yeah. I mean, my history began actually back in 1982 when I was 16 years old. And I was in the Air Cadets, which is a youth organisation for the Royal Air Force, and I did my gliding proficiency certificate, so I soloed at 16, and then after that, at age 17, I won a Royal Air Force flying scholarship, which meant that I had to go through various selection procedures, which you'd normally expect to go through for Royal Air Force pilot,
right?
But you do it at a slightly younger age, and if you're successful in that, then you get awarded a Royal Air Force flying scholarship. And the selection procedures, interviews, and aptitude tests and medical, that sort of thing, usually takes a few days down at Biggin Hill.
So you're kind of on the fast track for
a military career,
a Royal Air Force career.
Yeah, yeah. So I won this flying scholarship, which paid for 30 hours of flight training at an approved school.
Oh, that's right, you told me that it takes 36 hours to get a license.
That's right, yeah, 36 hours to get a PPL. And thankfully my dad, he took pity on me, and he managed to raise an extra, I think it was a couple of £1,000 at the time, which is still a lot of money back
then.
Yeah,
that is.
Yeah, and so he paid for me to take the extra 6 hours. Or I think I actually did it in slightly less than 36 hours because I'd soloed on a power launch glider. I was allowed a couple of hours or so off of the 36. So it wasn't that much more. So, and in fact, it might not have been £2,000. It might have been significantly less than that.
Excellent.
It's a long time ago. but anyway, I got my PPL at age 17. And but unfortunately, around about the same time, I had a motorcycle accident, which caused a serious injury to my knee, and that pretty much terminated. It did terminate my military flying career. Although I held out for some time, I went through the Royal Navy selection process.
Hmm.
I was awarded a start date with the Royal Navy at Britannia College for the 5th of November 1985, but that was subject to medical fitness at time of entry, so my naval aviation career was terminated as well.
The knee held you up again.
It did, yeah.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, spending a few years in and out of hospital, having my knee fixed up, meant I didn't pursue a commercial flying career.
Right.
And I ended up doing quite a few different things, mainly in the field of IT.
Right.
But then...
But your PPL stays current.
Well, it did and it didn't.
Okay.
I kept my PPL going for a bit and I let it go, and then I breathed life back into it again and let it go. But I'm one of those guys who, unless you're going to fly for a purpose...
Right.
Then I don't see any point in flying at all. And I never really got much of a kick out of floating around in a Cessna 150 or 172. No offence to people who like that.
Right.
But if I'd geared myself up to an air military flying career, fast jets or whatever it might have been, it was too tough a pill to swallow.
Yeah.
So well, I just couldn't get my head around it. But I stayed... doing sort of IT work and various other ventures, and then when I got to age 39 in around 2004, 5, I decided that I've just got to go back into aviation.
Right, and go get all the commercial ratings, go through the whole...
That's it.
How, so you had your PPL, and it was still current, so you could start off not getting a PPL, you go straight for the commercial licenses.
Yeah.
Had things changed since 85?
In terms of what?
You had to know, and...
Yeah.
In terms of even the process of doing it. I mean, the JAR, was it a JAR in the 80s?
No, it was CAA back then, Civil Aviation Authority.
Yeah, the JAR came around, that's the European license, stands for Joint
Aviation Regulations.
Regulations.
Things had changed, and also I think another reason why I hadn't flown a lot was I didn't believe that I knew enough to be a great pilot, and if I can't do something properly,
right,
I'm not going to do it at all.
Right, right.
So if you're not flying regularly, you're not flying quite a few hours a year.
Yeah.
Then, in my opinion, you're not necessarily that safe.
But I think I told you that even in my recent history, and I was only flying 400 hours a year, 400 or 500, I felt like my skills were slipping, and I kind of had to go back to Alaska to start flying quite a bit more and more consistently to bring the skills back up to a level that I was happy with.
Yeah.
And so I hear you on that.
Yeah, being current is everything.
It is. And, yeah, flying a couple hundred hours a year doesn't quite do it.
No.
So back to the licenses. We got back into it, get your JAR, and things had changed. I mean, it's a complicated license to get.
It is, yeah. First of all, you need to have a PPL.
Right.
You needed to have so many hours on that PPL. And unfortunately, if I briefed myself before this interview, I could probably tell you what that was, but you needed a certain number of hours. The first thing you do is you need to get stuck into these 14 different exams.
Right.
And you can take either two routes. You can take what's called a modular route, or you can take an integrated route. Most of the younger guys who are perhaps coming out of university at age 23, 24, whatever, they tend to take an integrated route through an organisation like Flight Training Europe or Britannia or through Oxford Aviation, and then they'll take all their 14 exams, and then they'll come out of the academic side of it and then go through and continue to do their flight training or flight tests.
Okay, so you split the academic side with the flight training. They're two separate.
If you're modular.
Right, okay.
Yeah, but if you're integrated, both sides, the flight training and the academic, will be within the same organisation.
Okay.
Now, some of the top airlines, like, say, British Airways, from what I understand, they like to have someone who's come from an integrated training background, whereas the modular isn't quite so sought after. But in my position, modular was, without a shadow of a doubt, the way to go.
Right, it was just a simpler way to go and cheaper. And it fit your lifestyle better.
It did, yeah. At the time, I was married.
Got it.
Say no more. As I said, that's at the time. And I went to London Metropolitan University for, I think it was about 7 months. So I commuted an hour in, an hour out. I got there at something like 8:30, 9 o'clock in the morning, and I left there about 4:30 in the evening. I got home about 6:30 in the evening. I'd study an extra couple of hours, and I did that for about 7 months.
So you were basically a full-time student?
Yeah.
To get through the 14 subjects?
That's it. Yeah, and people who are listening won't be able to see this, but I've still got the books on my shelf here. And so we studied airframes and systems, electrics, power plant, principles of flight, performance, operational procedures, air law, instrumentation, communications, human performance and limitations, general navigation, flight planning, meteorology, radio navigation, and mass and balance. that's all. I think that's all 14 of them.
I counted them earlier.
And I think you'll agree, Aidan, that you're looking at those books. They are well thumbed through books.
Oh yeah, I took a picture on the phone of the one. It's well marked up. Yeah. And for the people going through the U.S. system, pretty much each one of these books is as thick and as in-depth as our. We tend to have three sections. We do, you've got your private pilot, your PPL, your commercial and instrument. And our three books, well, any one of these sections is the equivalent of one of our books. So we have three sections, you have 14.
Yeah.
And I lead through some of these books, and they are definitely more in-depth than our books go.
Yeah.
To a degree where I'm not sure that you need to know that.
I'm a bit reluctant to comment on that as to how much of what I learned is relevant or needed. The fact of the matter is, it's what was required, so you do it.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, those books stacked up, what's about a foot and a half thick of book there.
Yeah.
And then we've got another 2 foot of other learning materials there. So it was tough, yeah. It was very, very challenging, but it was very rewarding at the end of the day to pass all of those exams.
Right. And so you can pass, so you have to pass those 14 exams. And like you're saying, you can do those separate from the flight part.
Yeah.
And probably I'm thinking of like converting a license. I think when you convert a license, you still have to do these 14 exams. And the way you can save money converting is on the flight time. You don't have to do all the flight exams. You just have to do the final one. I need to look into that. But I'm pretty confident you have to take the 14 exams to convert a license.
Well, you mean talking about converting an FAA
to an FAA or JAR. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I think you're right. In fact, I even talked to some ex-military guys in RAF, and they were talking about one.
They have to do it.
Yeah, they've got to go through that as well. I think so. I wouldn't spend my life on it, but I think they do.
I think you're right. I think in the U.S. the same thing. You have to, you come out of the military, you still have to take, you still have to do, to convert your military license, it just doesn't automatically convert over. You still have to take your written exams and maybe a flight, a test flight.
Yeah. But interestingly also, we were under a lot of pressure for first-time passes.
Oh.
And which I managed, and also to get a very high average.
Right.
So I think anything less than 70, well, I managed an 87. I know guys were into their 90s.
Right.
They're studying that hard. You were the higher average and no fails. Always first time. And that really raised your chances, apparently,
for getting a job.
Yeah.
Well, when your competition is, getting high averages and not failing.
Mm.
Yeah, that's not. If you're the one who stands out as slightly below average, they're not going to pick you. It's a field where they can pick. You know, they've got their pick of the pilots.
They could measure you somehow.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is a way to do it.
Well, just like your military thing, the knee is a way of. And I said about my eyes. You know, my eyes went bad. That's it, you're out. Yeah. Whereas if you're in the military and your eyes go bad, they'll keep you.
Yeah.
So it's just a way of eliminating a huge chunk of the candidates. So when you finish all the written exams, then you move on to the flight training part.
Yeah. So if you're integrated, you remain with that organization, simply get on to the flying side.
Right.
And in my case, I went and trained with Flight Training Europe, which is based in Jerez in Spain. And they also do integrated.
Okay.
I'm not sure they do modular anymore. I think I was one of the last modular students to go through FTE, Flight Training Europe.
Right.
Very, very professional outfit.
Right.
You wore a uniform. And they'd pretty much taken over an old, what used to be a Spanish airbase there.
Uh-huh.
So it even had a slightly military feel.
Yeah,
to it,
yeah.
But very, very, very professional. And the way they handled the training there was they considered that if you're going to take a commercial license, it's pointless doing it on a single engine.
Right.
They'll give you some local familiarization flights in a single engine, but in terms of taking your commercial license straight into a multi-engine, and so you do your multi-engine rating,
right,
and then you do your commercial training on that multi, and then once you finish the commercial license, you'd then go on to the multi-engine instrument rating.
Okay, so the instrument, yeah, usually in the U.S. we usually do instrument first, then multi. Mm-hmm. So you actually do commercial first, then on the instrument.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's and my guess is that part of their logic between about going with the multi-plane right off the bat, mm-hmm. everything with the JAR is geared towards the airlines.
Yeah.
I mean, it is an airline license more so than a U.S. commercial license, where yeah. there's. You can certainly use it for different types of flying. I mean, it's still a very good license, but the focus is getting towards flying the jets, flying with a crew.
Yeah.
And that's really that's where they assume everybody's headed towards.
Yeah, certainly the route I was taking, and all my colleague or pose, or what you would call them, the guys we were training with, and the girls, as it
right.
was, were aiming for the airline job. So once you finished your multi-engine instrument rating, your next step was certainly you want to do what we call an MCC, multi-crew cooperation course,
right.
or a JOC or jet orientation course. And I think back then, certainly Flight Training Europe did do both of those, I think.
Okay.
But what happened with me was... I kind of like ran out a little bit of time with examiners who were coming from another part of Europe, and there were weather conditions taking place at the time, but I kind of like missed my slot.
Right.
So I had to go back to England with planning to come back in several weeks later when the examiners were available again. But as it turned out, that wasn't working out too well. So I decided to go to a place called Exeter, which is in the southwest of the UK.
Right.
And a flight school called Flight Pass. And I completed my multi-engine instrument rating there. Just took another 6 or 7 hours to just complete that.
And get up to speed and then use their examiners.
That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then after that, I went to Park Aviation in Dublin, where I did my multi-crew cooperation, the MCC, on the 737-200, which was a 40-hour course. And that's
wow.
20 hours in the left seat and 20 hours in the right seat.
And this is all still required for the JAR license? Or is it above and beyond?
I think the MCC is above and beyond.
Okay.
But certainly, if you want
if you're gonna get a
JAR ATPL, you've basically got to have a multi-engine instrument rating, CPL,
right.
And these 14 exams behind you. And really, you're not going anywhere without multi-crew cooperation course.
Right. Again, it's all geared towards an airline environment.
Towards the airline, yeah. And then after that, if you haven't spent enough time and money.
That's a common phrase in aviation training, by the way.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I hear you. But yeah, if you haven't spent enough time and money, then you then need to start paying for a type rating.
Because you're not going to get a job without a type. But
you can. Yeah, you can. I mean, some of the airlines were offering kind of what you might call cadetships, where... The airline would either finance it, or they would either pay for it, or they would help you, or they would kind of loan you it,
right,
or they would tie you in for X number of years.
Yeah, yeah.
And when you're talking, I don't know, say £20,000 or more,
right.
for a 737 or an A320. Or A319.
And you've just spent £100,000 in all your training.
Well, if you budget £60,000 in 18 months, at that time,
right.
you would get there.
And that's equivalent in US, but that would be about $80,000, $90,000 US dollars. Mm. So it's actually, that's not Well, it's more expensive than the U.S. The U.S. a little bit cheaper. So you ended up doing the MCC then.
Yeah.
To further the chance of getting a job.
Yeah.
And you kind of, you almost have to. It's like, it's not, it's an option, but not really.
Yeah. The MCC alone was, I think it was around 6,000.
Okay, and your type ratings, and this is where it differs in a lot of countries. In the U.S., you know, you've single engine land, single engine sea, and you fly any single engine plane, multi-engine land, multi-engine sea, any single, any multi-engine plane up to 12,500 pounds. Mm. That's where we start counting our type ratings. Do you count a type rating, like if you're going to fly a, if you're going to go from a Cessna 152 over to flying a, like a Bonanza, Beechcraft Bonanza, would that be a separate type rating, or is that still just single engine land?
That's a good question. I'm probably not the right person to answer that one. With a multi-engine piston rating, I think you can fly most multi-engine pistons, providing you have a check ride.
Okay.
I honestly don't know what point an aircraft becomes complicated enough to require a type rating.
Separate certificate.
Yeah.
Okay, because I know like the Kiwis and Aussies, it's, you know, we were talking earlier, like I can fly a Caravan, but to fly a PAC 750, I need a new type rating in the PAC 750. I need an add-on to my license.
Yeah.
Even though it's a single turbine.
Unique to them.
It may be a Kiwi thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or, well, it is a lot of places in the world, but damn Kiwis.
But with the Catalina, I was surprised that I don't actually need a multi-engine rating, a multi-engine piston rating.
Oh, because you get a type.
You do it on a type.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
Let's finish up with the flight school real quick, and let's move on to Catalina, because Catalina is pretty damn cool. So you finished up, so you did, you went through all the procedures, and the JAR took about 18 months.
Yeah.
7 months on the book learning, and then about another, close to a year doing the flight training.
Yeah, because it was slightly broken up.
Right, right.
And there were, you know, periods of time when you're between training for one reason or another.
Right, which that happened, weather's bad, or,
or
they don't have a slot for you for a month, and you got to get in there.
Exactly. And I didn't come straight out of the academic side and straight into the flight training. I'd spent some time shopping around as to where I was going to go, and I had to wait until the next course was starting. And then you've got things like weather coming into effect and money, of course.
Of course,
yeah.
And did you like the modular training plan?
Yeah, it suited me.
It worked for you.
Yeah, I think if I were a younger person coming out of, say, university, I would go for the integrated, really because it's probably simpler.
Right.
And also, I think there's probably a better chance of getting a job at the end of it, because I think certainly the high-end airlines...
That's what they want to see.
Yeah, they do kind of prefer, I think, this sort of integrated... product.
Right, right. Well, I know in the U.S. it's all integrated now. They even, in private license stuff, they start incorporating instrument. Yeah. They're even integrating instrument flying into a private PPL just because it makes sense.
Mm.
And for me, I would work better integrated, because I would see how stuff relates to each other. But different people learn different ways. And a singer would sit down with these books, and he would just get a kick out of learning all this stuff. And he, and the flying would be a distraction for him.
Right.
Like, he would do much better sitting down learning this and then do the flying, and he'd get really into that.
Right.
So I know different people learn different ways, and it's nice to have an option between the two thoughts. So when you finished all your ratings, did you have a clear idea of what you wanted to do? Were you looking at the airlines right after that? Or?
Yeah, I had, my plan was to go straight into the airlines. I sent my CV out to copious airlines. But at the time, I'd literally just passed the big 4-0.
Right.
And I didn't get one response. And I don't know whether...
The age had a factor, but...
It's a little bit, it's a strange subject, almost a sore subject, but There were no takers.
And they told you my theory on that is that you just don't fit their profile.
Yeah.
You know, they're looking for a certain, 22 to 30 years old, finish their ratings, and they want somebody who fits into that little envelope. Yeah. And you're just outside of it. And so again, it's like they can pick from here, so why go outside, even though they might get a better employee, that better pilot out of it.
Yeah.
You know, I always think you're 40 years old, you've got more life experience, a little more mature.
But I didn't fit the profile. I'm pretty convinced that was the case. And of course,
I'm guessing you're right.
And at the time, I had a house, I had a mortgage, my partner with her two children, I had a family to support, and I just had to I had to do something.
Go back into IT.
Yeah, so I went back into IT, and IT, when you're in the right place, is pretty lucrative.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it can be quite stable.
Yeah.
And that's where I stayed remained within IT for good 4 or 5 years. And then I realized that my tickets were starting to run out.
Right.
I hadn't forgotten how much time and effort and money I spent on them.
Took to get them all together.
Yeah. So, and I hadn't flown in those 4 or 5 years either. It was a case of I didn't get a job. I've got to go back into IT. That's it. I've got to concentrate on that career and earning that money.
Yeah.
And I had to literally shelve flying. So at the end of those 4 or 5 years, I needed to renew my multi-engine, renew my CPL, which is just paperwork.
Right.
I had to renew my multi-engine piston, which was some recurrent training and a flight test, and take the written examination again.
And to go back.
What's a critical engine? All that kind of stuff.
All that stuff goes right out of your head.
Yeah. It's a little bit of studying that comes back.
It does come back.
The most challenging thing for me after that period of time was the multi-engine instrument.
Single pilot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because for any pilot, that is probably a commercial pilot, that is the most challenging thing. And if you haven't flown for a little while, then to get your head back around that again is pretty tough. And I did find it tough. But I did it.
I'm going to throw a bone to Singer here. Did you use flight sim at all to try to get up to speed?
I would like to have done, but I had enough on my plate trying to get my head back into the flying without having to figure out how to get flight sim all set up.
Right.
Because you're not just talking about learning the software and how to get the best out of that. You're talking about setting up your hardware as well, your PC and all the peripherals required.
And getting a yoke and pedals.
Yeah. So that in itself is a challenge, and I had enough of a challenge already. So I concentrated my learning on
the real plane.
Well, the real plane, as much as you can afford it.
Yeah.
And also the school simulator, the FNPT.
Oh, okay, so you had a sim you could get in school.
Yeah.
Okay, so I think sims are an excellent way to try to stay current.
Yeah.
When you can't afford to get in a plane.
Yeah.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. I couldn't agree more.
I hate sims, but they sure are good.
Yeah. Well, I enjoyed my time in the simulator.
Well, you and Singer, you're both IT guys. You know how to. I'm terrible at sims.
I'll sit down with you one day and you can help me figure this stuff out. But I really love to do that because it's a great way. If you're not got a lot of money to stay current in real things, it's superb.
It really is.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I've thought it. I've sat down with Singer and flown sims before if I was feeling uncurrent. Or I was talking about that King Air that I picked up, and I had never flown a ProLine 21 system.
Yeah.
So it's like, well, let's download a ProLine and let's figure this stuff out in the simulator. Then it's amazing how well it translates to a real airplane. Back to you. So you did get back current again. You got all your license renewed.
Yeah.
And then somehow you ended up owning a piece of a Catalina.
Yeah. So I got my multi-engine instrument rating back, and my MEP and my CPL, and then I thought, right, what am I going to do now? All I knew was I was in a real hurry to sort that out before it all expired to a point that it was going to become more of a nightmare to renew.
Right.
So I'd done that, and then I relaxed again. I thought, what am I going to do with this now? And I didn't do anything with it for another year. Almost another year, actually. Probably about 9 months. And I started to get a little bit panicky about it. But anyway, I went with a friend of mine to Duxford in July 2012 for the air show. And we were sitting on a grassy knoll, soaking up the sun, watching Catalina.
Grassy knolls in the US are a bad
thing. Oh, yeah, JFK, isn't it? Yeah, okay. Withdrawn. It was just a grassy slope.
A grass, that sounds better. I hadn't done anything with my license, I was a little depressed. I'm sitting on a grassy knoll. That sounds really bad.
Yeah, I'll take it out on the next president. It's a grassy slope, and we were sitting there watching the Catalina do its air show piece.
Uh-huh.
And they were commentating this over the tannoy for everybody, and they're just mentioning that Catalina is privately owned by a syndicate of 20 shareholders, and that some of these shareholders are pilots, and these pilots get to fly the Catalina to air shows throughout the UK and Europe. So I stood up immediately and marched up to where I knew the Catalina would be parking once it finished its display, and I had a quick chat with the ground crew there. And then
signed me up.
Yeah, got into the aircraft. Had a chat with Rod Brooking, who was the captain on the aircraft that day, who put me in touch with Paul Warren Wilson, who's the boss. And I got on the phone to him within an hour from the car park, and I said to him, I want that share. There's only one share left.
Yeah.
So I want it.
He said there's another one up on eBay right now.
There is, yeah. There is. Yeah, check it out.
That's tempting.
Yeah. It is. Well, you know, so you can pay that little bit of money. Should I say how much it was?
Sure.
Yeah, £17,500 for one 20th share. Yeah.
But then, you get to own part of a living history, living flying history.
And you get to fly it.
And you get to fly it, yeah.
Yeah. And within that, I get my type rating as well.
That's right. That's right. So yeah, you have your type rating coming up in about a month now.
Yeah.
And so that keeps you current, and then you get to start actually flying the plane.
Yeah.
And it's a plane that you own.
Yeah.
A part of.
Yeah.
And you get to fly at air shows.
Yeah.
And let's talk more about the foundation that the Catalina is. And it is a consortium of people who own it.
Yes.
But it's under a bigger foundation that's called the.
Yeah, the aircraft is was purchased by Catalina Aircraft Limited.
Okay.
Well, it's operated by Plain Sailing Limited.
Okay.
There's reasons behind all of that, which if you want to become a shareholder, they'll be explained to you.
Right, probably legal reasons. And,
because the amount of money you put in is bought into a £1 share.
Right.
The rest is a loan to the company, and there's reasons behind all of that.
Right.
If people want to know, then we can explain out of the interview for that. But,
or then go to the website, which we'll post up there.
Yeah.
And the idea is to keep this plane flying.
Yes.
Keep this piece of living history flying, and
not
just static in a museum, but actually flying, operating plane.
Yeah.
And by the way, for those of you who haven't seen it or if we haven't posted it yet, I never know how this stuff ends up coming out, but we have a walkthrough of the Catalina, a video, which it's a cool plane. And while we were at Duxford doing this walkthrough, they pulled out, two Spitfires.
Two Spitfires.
A P-47, a P-51.
A Razorback
P-51.
A Hurricane landed,
and then a Spitfire took off and did an air show for us.
Yeah.
Doing loops, and that was awesome.
Yeah. Well, that's Duxford, which is the largest collection of airworthy warbirds in Europe.
That's cool. Yeah. Back to Catalina and your foundation then. Did they... So you have a website, obviously, and you take donations for the foundation or the plane sailing?
Well, the way
raise money.
Raise money is each of the shareholders pays £150 a month.
Okay. That's for maintenance and just maintenance costs on the plane and the upkeep and the hangar space.
Very basic stuff.
Yep.
And then the aircraft charges for doing displays.
Right.
And she's very busy.
Yep.
So she does wash her face.
What did you say? She's heading to Paris today.
Yeah, she's off to Paris today. With her to Weiss in Germany at the end of May. And she's booked into air shows all over UK. I mean, last year, she went as far as Moscow Iceland.
So that's cool.
There's no place we can't go.
And you should get some good, some decent flying out of this too.
Yeah.
And that's a cool old plane to fly.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to the challenge of flying the aircraft. And I'm also looking forward to flying with the group of pilots that we have. I think there was one air show, the total number of hours the crew had was 30,000.
Right, so you've got some people who are kind of starting off, you are.
Yeah.
And then you've got a lot of the senior captains, they're flying, they're either retired from airline jobs.
Yeah, we've got guys who are ex-airline or are still in airline and flying 747s, and we've got a very young French pilot who's, I think he's flying Airbus, and he's in his late 20s. We've got a guy who's a flight instructor at school that I renewed my RTIR at. And we've got another pilot who's a test pilot for the Civil Aviation Authority.
It's a diverse crew.
Yeah, and we've got serving airline pilots. And Paul has got a military background flying Harriers.
It's right. You were talking about the Harriers when we were looking at it in the museum.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's...
So I'm rubbing shoulders with some pretty experienced guys, and I want some of that to rub off on me. I want to soak up their experience.
Yeah, just rub their shoulder while you're flying. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of them are probably going to be pretty used to kind of mentoring people too, I would think.
Yeah.
Which is pretty cool.
Yeah, and the guys I've met so far are superb. They're just such a great bunch of people. And alongside them, you've got the other shareholders that aren't pilots. They're a great bunch. They're just in it because they want to own a piece of aviation history and keep it alive.
Yeah.
And then you've got what we call the Cat Pack, which is all the volunteers who turn up on a regular basis at the airfield to out of season, say between October and sort of March, April. The aircraft is hangared, and its stable mate is the B-17. And anyway, so I'll just chuck a little bit.
Which is the Memphis Belle.
Huh?
Which is the Memphis Belle.
Yes.
The Susie B has two names.
It does, doesn't it? Memphis Belle and...
the Susie B or something.
Yes, that's it.
Yeah.
So anyway, so when she's hangared in there during the winter, having maintenance, having engine overhauls and all that sort of thing... volunteers come in, and I did about 70 hours volunteer work on her over the 2012-13 winter period, and met up with all these guys who come from all walks of life. Some of them are ex-military airframe engine, some of them don't know one end of a screwdriver to the other when they first arrive, and then we get them scraping paint.
And you fit them in where their skill set fits.
That's it.
Sweeping the floor, maybe.
Yeah.
Or scraping paint, that's a better job.
Yeah, but I mean, everyone mucks in, and everyone has a great time.
Yeah.
Everyone has this common interest in keeping this fantastic old warbird in the air and commemorating all of the air crew who flew it during the war, and many of whom never came home.
When your plane is Miss Pickup, which is named after another Catalina that didn't come back from the war.
That's right, yeah. It was the 30th of March 1943, and she was going to pick up a downed airman in the North Sea field. His name was Daniel Mayers, I think. He flew, it was flying a P-51D Mustang. He'd been escorting B-17s over Hamburg, and he'd come back. He'd got engine trouble about 18,000 feet. He had to bail out. I think his call sign was Super Wolf. Sounds good.
That sounds like something from Top Gun.
He ended up in the North Sea, and this particular Catalina was escorted by his buddies, actually, I think, to the scene. And they landed quite close to him, and unfortunately an oil line came loose. It's quite a heavy landing.
Rough seas,
yeah,
I would guess.
Absolutely. So they lost, I think, a right engine. And, of course, a twin-engine float plane doesn't taxi too well. So they weren't that very able to position themselves to try and pick him up. So he actually drifted out of sight and was eventually picked up by the Germans. And this is off the Dutch coast. And
cold water.
But as far as I understand, he survived the war.
Must have been in his raft.
Yeah, he was on a raft. And the next morning, a couple of Messerschmitt 262s spotted the aircraft still on the water from being there overnight.
Right.
And strafed it in the water. The crew managed to get away in their dinghy, and I think they were picked up off Great Yarmouth.
Wow.
So no one was killed on that occasion. The aircraft was lost.
Right.
But the number on the tail and the miss pickup hull art.
Yeah, the hull art, not the nose art.
Not the nose art.
And she is quite attractive.
She's very nice.
The plane and the hull art.
Yeah, if you see the aircraft walkthrough video, you'll
see it.
You'll be able to see that. Yeah.
So it was the ME-262s that strafed her, huh?
Apparently so. Yeah. See, we were waste of high performance jets strafing Catalina in the North Sea. You'd have thought they'd have bigger targets up there to take care of, but
you would think.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was the first fighter jet in operation, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
Except maybe the Comet or some other German. Interesting, isn't it? So everybody lived, and the plane was lost, and your plane is now commemorating.
That's it.
Miss Pickup.
Yeah, it's a white paint job, and that is the colour scheme which the OA-10 had for the 5th Emergency Rescue Squadron
Okay.
of the United States Army Air Force. Okay, that's all sounded weird, my tongue twister. But the OA-10 is the designation for the Catalina, which is configured for rescue operations, or what they used to call Dumbo missions.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, we got more of that history on the walkthrough as well.
Yeah.
Given that I have a flight to catch tomorrow, and we have another beer to drink probably before we do that.
Yeah.
And we'll pick up with you again after you get the type rating, see how she flies.
I'll be happy to tell you all about it. I'm really looking forward to it.
That'll be awesome. Yeah. I'll enjoy flying the plane. Anything else you'd like to add, though, real quick?
I'm fine.
Cool. All right. Well, enjoy flying the plane. And Aiden and Gareth with Oddball Pilot.
Okay.
Signing out.
Cheers.